You paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Good morning, Steve Dales, Pet World on WGN with an old friend, Dr. Aaron Jackson, a small animal surgeon with Midwest Veterinary Surgical Services. Dr. Jackson, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Hopefully our pets are okay, too. But I want to jump right to it. I think that, and this is just my guess, the question you get asked most often before you do any surgery on a pet is about the anesthesia. It is correct, you said, and especially with older pets, I imagine. So with that being the first question out of the box, can you respond?
I can. So I don't look at age as age being itself. We all get older. You know, there's no doubt about that.
Hold it.
Get older, we get older.
Hold it. I disagree with that. I don't have time for the getting older. But go ahead. I interrupted. I apologize.
So, yeah, as we get older, our body ages and things change. But, you know, when we approach anesthesia, it is mainly the question that I want owners to ask is, not is my pet too old to have anesthesia, but the question should be reframed. Is my pet healthy enough to have anesthesia? Because I'd rather have an older, healthier 12-year-old dog that is in perfect health for anesthesia than an unregulated cardiac patient that's 2 years old. You know, that patient's more unstable and a higher risk for anesthetic complications. So the question becomes, again, you know, is my pet healthy enough for anesthesia? And now, an older pet that has heart disease, liver disease, or, you know, some other organ failure, yeah, they're obviously not going to have the same reserves that we have, because that's what happens when we get older. Our reserves and our ability to be able to handle things go down. But it doesn't mean that being old is a contraindication to anesthesia.
Is knee surgery or cruciate surgery the most common surgery you do?
It is quite a bit, and it's coming up on that cruciate season. You know, as it gets warmer outside, depending on the day and this recent weather, but as it gets warmer, our patients have been, you know, homebound inside for much of the winter, not used to exercising. Warm weather comes out, everybody wants to go and run, they play, take a sharp turn, tear their ligament, and then they end up, you know, coming to see us. You see me or another surgeon.
All right. So I have lots of questions about that. Prevention, of course, would be best. Is there a way to actually, and I'll be talking to a rehab medicine specialist, Dr. Leilani Alvarez, who wrote a book about all this in a couple of weeks. But is there a way to stretch, exercise before so you're not being a, what is it called, a weekend warrior or something of that nature?
Yeah, there are ways to do that, and it's kind of similar to what we do, you know. I'm of the age now that I have to stretch in bed before I can get out of bed to stretch again so I can walk downstairs and not fall. Yeah, and so I will find myself stretching, and, you know, and our pets are the same way. They need to kind of warm up and do some stretch, especially if you're going to go out on a weekend warrior type of a mode and you know, go out frisbee throwing or, you know, racing at the dog park or anything like that. They need to stretch and warm up and get the body moving before they start trying to do too much. Yeah. And some of it's just plain old conditioning, you know, walking and doing exercise. You know, if our pets are overweight and, you know, kind of like mine, I'm overweight and the pets are overweight, you know, probably not a good idea for me to go out and try to play baseball or softball like I did a couple of years ago and break my ankle. But it's one of those things where, yeah, we want to get them up and moving and kind of ease into it. And then, you know, let them turn loose. Our pets are a lot more active in general than most of us. And, you know, they jump on the couch, off the couch, run around the house, run up and down stairs. You know, we don't do that. You know, as typically, we don't do things like that. So, you know, you want to make sure that you warm them up and get them used to moving before going out on a long run or a long day hike or something like that.
Okay, so cruciate surgery I also brought up for another reason. As an example, potentially, of spectrum of care. People can't, in some cases, afford what might be ideal or for the lifestyle of the animal. So when you talk to a client about their dog or that may require but may not require this surgery, does affordability play a role in all this? Are there choices depending on the lifestyle of the pet and the people involved?
Oh, there's a lot of choices. And, you know, the one thing I have always for the, oh gosh, how long I've been doing this, 28 years, I've been a veterinarian and been doing surgery here in Chicago for 24 years now. It's hard to believe it. But I do tell people that think about their own financial, you know, ability to be able to pay things. As veterinary care has gotten terribly expensive. And I recognize that, you know, I didn't grow up with a lot of money and recognize that things are expensive. And yes, we need to make sure, and it's okay for owners to question a veterinarian and go, do I have to do this? You know, if I don't do this surgery, what will happen to my pet? I tell people all the time, take a breath, you know, breathe, figure out, go home, write down your notes, take down notes as soon as you get in the car, what was said, is this an emergency, what will happen if my pet doesn't have surgery, and much is this going to cost, and what does that cost include? And even with the spectrum of care, who's doing the surgery, is it a boarded surgeon, is it a non-boarded surgeon, is it, you know, it does these a lot, a little. I get people, I've been doing this a long time, I've done, you know, thousands of dogs, and I still have people ask, how many of these have you done? I never get offended by it, because if it was my child or my dog, I would want to know the same thing. And so I think it's good to ask questions and see what it is you're getting and then compare. You know, if you hear an answer that goes, oh, I don't know, you know, I can't afford this. I think there's certain procedures it's okay to get a second opinion on, as long as it's not an emergency. ACL repair or cranial cruciate repair in dogs, cats, I think it's okay to ask, you know, is there another opinion? Is this cost different? You know, what does that include? You know, I think there's nothing wrong with asking that. I've never been a believer in, as a pet owner, that people should go into severe debt to take care of their pets. And I don't think that's a good mentality to think, okay, I have to leverage every piece of disposable income I have to take care of my pet.
And sometimes
you may want to do that, but I don't want people to feel that way.
And depending on the surgery we're talking about, which is why I brought up cruciate surgery, sometimes there are choices that don't necessarily involve surgery or don't involve surgery tomorrow, I think, Dr. Jackson.
100%. I had this conversation a couple of weeks ago with an owner. And, you know, the patient came in to me because it was, you know, limping off and on at home and needed surgery. Was told it needed surgery, came in to see me and said, well, how are the dogs doing at home? What's running around? Okay, then why are you here? Well, I was told I needed surgery. Well, if they're, you know, the whole goal of surgery, you know, the way I look at it is to get them back to being a pet, being able to run, play, do the things that they want to do. If they come in that day and they see me and they're not having issues, why am I going to do surgery? You know, it'd be the same as, you know, when my doctor tells me, hey, you know, you may need this surgery down the road. And well, you know, I know my football playing days are over. I don't, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I go and play with my kids and everything. And it's like, I don't need it.
No. Nope.
But if it gets to be a problem where it affects the quality of life, then that's a different conversation. And that's usually the way I look at it. What is the quality of life? And I tell people a lot, you know, a lot of my clients will say, they will hear this and say, yes, he said that. I tell people to put a calendar on their fridge, write down good day and bad days. You know, was this a good day? We were having issues. Was this a bad day? Not having issues.
Well, Dr. Jackson, this will be a bad day for me if I don't break for commercials. But we'll be right back with Dr. Aaron Jackson on WGN. Dr. Aaron Jackson is a boarded small animal surgeon, also from Midwest Veterinary Surgical Services, and traveling around doing what you do, surgery, for many, many years. And you brought up some common sense valid points, I think, about whether, okay, that surgery needs to be done in the first place. So let's say the surgery is done, not necessarily knee surgery that we've been talking about, but any surgery. How important today, from our understanding of the emotion of the animal, is pain relief? And I think you also have more tools at your disposal than you did, for example, when you began doing all of the work that you do now.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Pain is very serious. Nobody likes our pets to be in pain. We don't like to be in pain. Being in pain decreases the speed in which you heal. It can cause complications. Our body changes, with organ function, how we heal when we're in pain. Blood pressure goes up. It makes us more susceptible to infections. The animals lick the incisions more when they're in pain. So there's a lot of things that go into that. And so, yeah, we have a lot more tools available, for pain control. There's nerve blocks that we can do with or without ultrasounds or nerve stimulator epidurals that we do. There's newer drugs out that we give that are longer acting that last in the incision to help provide, 2 to 3 days worth of pain relief. There's narcotics that we can give now that are injectable that can last 2 or 3 days and help provide pain relief. So yeah, pain relief is a very, very, very important part of the surgery process.
All right. So one of those things that pet parents hate, but are very often amused by, are those collars that you give because you don't want the dog or cat to lick at whatever it was you did surgery for, and they will lick at the wound, especially, as you point out, if it hurts. Is there finally new technology when it comes to these?
There is. There's a lot of things that we can do. The old standby that I still like, in the end, is the Elizabethan collar, the E collar, the cone of shame. That's the one that works. It definitely works, and it works on most patients, but there's side effects to it. I'm convinced when my dog had it on, when he had surgery, I'm convinced he used it as a tool to punish me because he liked to run in the back of my leg with it. And it didn't hurt. And he would smile. I think it was on purpose. But looking at some patients don't eat with it. He's a bigger dog. He's able to eat around it and get to his bowl. Some cats will freeze up. You put a cone on them and they just sit in a corner and they stare at you and give you this evil stare. Yeah, and you're like, okay, I need to do something. And they won't eat. And so there's softer e-collars now that kind of bend backwards. There's donuts, we call them. They're inflatable kind of they look just like a donut that fit around the neck, and kind of you can inflate that keeps them from being able to bend and flex. Those work on some patients. They don't on others because they're able to still get the leg up and get to where they need to be. And then there's these sleeves that are around now and body suits that you can put and get to put over the affected limb or the leg or the body to protect the incision. And those work really well. And I've had a lot of my owners that really, really like those sleeves and help prevent them from licking it because it's a little easier. You don't have to worry about them knocking things over. If you have a Great Dane in the house and it has a cone on or an e-collar, it can go across the counter and just literally take everything off. And I've seen dogs do that where they just get upset and sweep everything off onto the floor and go, if I have to suffer, everybody's got to suffer.
You've done, as a boarded surgeon, thousands of surgeries of all kinds. What would you say is the most challenging surgery you've ever done?
Oh, that's a very good question. The most challenging surgery I have ever done. Probably the most challenging surgery I've ever done as far as technique would be the open heart surgeries where we have to, we don't do those a lot anymore, but do patch grafts where we have to inflow occlude the heart. So you stop all the blood flow to the heart, open it up, put the patch on, and then you restart everything. Those are probably the most challenging because they require a lot of team effort. And it's not just me that does the surgery. I have a very good team around me all the time. If I don't have my veterinary technicians doing the anesthesia and my assistants helping me, the surgery doesn't go well, but it's a team effort. So those are probably the hardest. The other most difficult are the ones where, you have to have a heart-to-heart conversation with the owner. Where you have masses and tumors that you're going to try to get out, but know that this may not go well. And so those are hard, because you have to be honest and upfront and tell people, look, this may not go well. And, we'll try our best, but, there's no absolutes and no guarantees in this.
And you do take everything to heart because veterinarians do. Can you think of an example where you thought, okay, the owner gave me approval, in fact, encouraged me to do it. I didn't know if the dog or cat would survive. In fact, I thought maybe the animal might not. It turned out the animal not only did, but thrived after. Can you think of an example or two? I suppose there are probably many.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's hundreds, if not thousands of those where, you know, I think, oh, is this going to be a good idea? I've had many surgeries where, you know, the owner and I discuss everything. We agree this is what we're going to do. Halfway through the surgery, I'm thinking this is not a good idea. And, you know, I either have another surgeon come and join me or another doctor come in and help. And we get through it. And in the end, it's like, all right, you know, everything worked out well. Hey, you know, and glad we did it. You know, those are the times that we live for with those. And, you know, you have to have a little, you know, surgeons get a rap for being very arrogant or very overconfident. But to do surgery, you kind of have to have those qualities to some extent. Otherwise, you can't be in there. You know, you can't get in the middle of surgery and start having self-doubt and going, okay, I can't do this. You have to be a very confident person, and not overconfident, but know your limits and be like, okay, we can do this. But there's a lot of surgeries I get in there and be like, oh, you know, is this going to go well? And I do take everything to heart. Most surgeons do, you know, are always looking at, you know, is this the right thing? You know, and it's the way I was trained in surgery. It's my natural personality is to help people, and surgeons like to fix things. And it's not good when we don't fix things. You know, it really makes us feel like we didn't do our job. We can't fix stuff.
Yeah, I would suggest that veterinary surgeons are more empathetic than human surgeons. And now I will get the emails and the letters because I said that. Dr. Aaron Jackson, small animal boarded in surgery. And by the way, you can be, and he is, boarded in surgery. Midwest Veterinary Surgical Services. Thank you so much.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Steve Dale's Pet World back on WGN Radio with Joe Rately. He is the creator of Greenies. We're going to talk about dental health in pets. We're going to talk about much more than that, too, including overweight and obese pets. He is, and he calls himself this, too, and you know what? I get it. An ambassador for dogs. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you. So what is your interest in gum disease in dogs?
Well, I have a real interest in dogs, as you said. I consider myself a self-appointed ambassador for dogs. And we have, this is shocking to me, 100 million dogs with either gum disease or overweight. Now, some of those dogs have both, because we only have 89.7 million dogs, yet we have 100 million of them that have symptoms of those diseases. And I just think that's not acceptable to me. I don't want my dog suffering like that, and I want people to know what to do. For example, I run into a lot of people who don't really even know how to check their dog's mouth to see if they do have the early stages of gum disease. It's very simple. Lift the lip up and look at the gum line, and if you see yellow or brown right near the gum line on the teeth, you got some tartar buildup, and that's the precursor to gum disease.
You know, we brush our teeth every day. Well, I hope I do. Usually I do. Several times a day, right? And most people
That's
do
correct.
As well. But our dogs don't do that. So imagine not having your teeth brushed for year after year after year after year. And if you think about it that way, Joe, I think no wonder there are problems. What are the problems that result from gum disease in dogs, which, as you point out, is incredibly common?
Yeah, you know, it's really all these things that I'll be talking about today, gum disease, excess weight, and obstruction, they all start in the mouth. They're oral related. And with gum disease, it's the plaque that comes from after the dog eats. It's kind of gooey, it's kind of sticky on the teeth. They get there and the bacteria join them up And if it's not cleaned off, it's going to turn into tartar on the teeth. That's that hard stuff that you normally can't scrape off. The good news is we have a product called Yummy Combs that is the first dental product that is clinically proven to actually remove tartar from dog's teeth. It doesn't get 100% of it, but we got over 25% off in a 60-day period.
All right, so let me go back a little bit in time here. When you created Greenies, they said that, oh, there's no product that a dog can chew that is going to do any good, but yet that did good. It's now a well-known product, but this is sort of new and improved and different, isn't it?
Well, yeah, when we started, my wife and I started Greenies because we had two Samoyed dogs that had horrible halitosis. We were trying to fix halitosis back then, and we did a pretty good job of that, I think. But it doesn't get to the real core of the matter of gum disease, which is the tartar building up on the teeth and then the bacteria hanging on. And it really gets into a bad situation because left unattended, gum disease most frequently turns into vital organ damage. And that means the dog's vital organs aren't going to function correctly. And I'm not going to say it, but y'all can figure out what can happen then.
Oh, well, let's talk about that a little bit, because if there's bacteria in the mouth that's there for a while, it is no surprise that eventually that bacteria will course through the dog's system and impact their vital organs. And what you just said has been shown in multiple studies to be true. So if people don't brush their dog's teeth, what are the options? And you created one of those options. So how does Yummy Combs work?
Well, they're very, very different. In fact, we've had quite a few dogs that the first time they get them kind of look at them and don't know what to do with them. They're shaped somewhat like a hockey puck, except rather than being round, they're hexagonal, but they are wide and flat. And then that hockey puck somehow flew into a bee's nest, apparently, because it's got little honeycomb-like cells on the entire top and bottom. And what happens is the ridges of those cells, when the dog bites down on it, actually floss the dog's teeth 360 degrees. Never been done before. And it also can scrub or brush the dog's teeth and help some there. But the other thing that we have is we have up to 200 scraping surfaces on these cells of the teeth, and that combined with a prescribed hardness that we use, that's what allowed us to remove tartar from dogs' teeth, which for decades and decades has been said it's impossible to do.
You know,
anything's possible if you're willing to pay the price.
I guess. So it had been suggested that just a dog having kibble rather than moist food does the trick to remove the tartar. And that, I believe, is a old wives' tale.
Well, you got to take degree of effectiveness into account. And I think something like a kibble can take off a little bit, but they're not really going to do the job that needs to be done to keep those doggone gums from ultimately bleeding, and then that's when the bad guy bacteria from the mouth get into the circulatory system, use it as a racetrack to the vital organs, and the vital organs is where the big, big damage actually ultimately occurs. But it starts in the mouth.
It does, and we don't pay enough attention to that, as you point out. Now, it would be, and I don't know that you agree or not, to me the gold standard would be brushing twice daily your dog's teeth. The reality is, though, that people, I don't believe I can explain to people from now through the end of time how to do that from a behavior perspective. I am a behavior guy, as you know. So I could tell people how to do it, and it would work. The problem is, in my experience, Joe, they don't do it. And I understand we're all busy. This is not criticism of any kind. But nevertheless, to me, that's the reality. So we need to do something else.
Yes. One of the things that the data clearly shows is that there's only about 6% of dog owners who are going to do brushing of their dog's teeth on a daily basis. The compliance rate is very low. It cannot or has not been proven that brushing can actually remove tartar from teeth. So I think we've got two things going in Yummy Cones favor. A, we've proven that, clinically proven, that we can remove tartar, and we have get dogs trained in about a day to like Yummy Cones, and therefore they're willing to put in the effort to chew on the Yummy Cone to get the desired results. It's doggy-powered teeth cleaning.
I love that. All right, when we come back, I want to talk about something I did not know about, and that is National Pet Choking Prevention Day, which is coming up in about a month or so, a month and a half, in mid-June. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about obstructions as well. We are talking on WGN with Joe Rately, and we'll be right back. First, he created Greenies, but that wasn't enough. He said, I've got to do better, and he has, with a product called Yummy Combs. But what we're really talking to Joe Rately about are a variety of different issues. One are dental issues. That is, Joe, would you say it's an epidemic among dogs, or not go that far?
Well, when you have more dogs that have combined infection, if I can call it that, of gum disease and overweight that exceeds the number of dogs, that means that we've got a heck of a lot of dogs that have it. And I really do think it is an epidemic, and it's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And hasn't had a real solution. I was fortunate in my work to come up with some things that really do work and really make it easy for the dog to do the work. And we did some real good things, I think, on the nutrition side. And I think we have the first four innovations in deterring obstructions. When dogs want to gulp something and get it down quickly and get it lodged in their throat, or it can even pass through into the bowels and block the bowels. But we've got four innovations on that, too.
All right. So I didn't know myself. There is such a thing as National Pet Choking Prevention Day.
Right.
It's June 22nd. Do I not quite, and it could be that I don't understand the or know about how common this issue is, whether it be dogs choking on toys or treats, actually household objects, even food. Does this happen more often than one might think about it, unless it has happened to you?
If it happens to you, you will remember it for the rest of your life. It is traumatic, it is dangerous, and it's costly when you have to go to the vet and they have to do surgery to get a large piece out of either the throat or the bowels. Can be either one. It is very much, there are no data that I can find on the incident rate. And I think that's very unfortunate, because without that, people don't know that it's important, so it gets overlooked, and then it turns out to be a bad news story oftentimes. That has been around for a couple of years now. Great praise to people for doing things like that to bring awareness to it and educate people on the real cost and danger that's involved in it. And I don't want to lose a pet. I don't want to lose a pet. They're too precious to me.
Yeah. So what do you recommend is, you know, avoidance is what it's all about, right? So how do we avoid that happening?
Well, I think what we did was I looked at how does it begin. Well, it begins by the dog choking something that's too big to go into the throat. So we actually have a board-certified veterinary dentist from Florida. His name's Dr. Jan Bellows, works with us. And when I first showed him a Yummy Combs, he said, holy cow, that's got so much implications. He said, I got a few ideas of how we can make that even better, and I'll do it for you. Every time I put a dog down for anesthesia, I will measure the throat opening. It's called the oropharynx, and give you the weight of the dog and the size of the opening, and you can then build the Yummy Combs so that they're larger than the throat opening, so the dog absolutely can't choke it. We build them bigger than that throat opening. So, and we build five sizes, so each size is per weight category. So we can pretty well block that. Now, that doesn't solve the whole issue, because the dog can also bite off a chunk and get it lodged in the throat or something. But we do three things for that. The way this was designed with these bee cell kind of things. It's very, very thin design. The thickest part on a Yummy Comb is barely a quarter of an inch thick. And you look at some of the other products, how thick they are, and you can tell how long it's going to take kind of to dissolve. Think about throwing a piece of lunch meat into a skillet to fry it. In a hot skillet, you throw it in it, and that's time to turn it over on the other side, and it's done. Now put a 3-inch thick roast on. How long does it take that? So thickness has something to do with it, so it can dissolve faster. We also have an ingredient we put in that helps it dissolve faster. And we had a biochemist that worked with us. Unfortunately, he passed away a year ago. But he came up with something that we call Slick'em. And it's a combination of ingredients that we put into the formula of Yummy Combs. And it is fascinating as heck to me, because if that Yummy Combs gets wetted by water, saliva, or later gaseous juices, it gets very, very slippery very quickly. I'm talking a matter of 10 to 15 seconds. It is slickened up, which lubricates it. So the dog's natural reaction when it has something lodged in its throat is to cough. So the dog coughs. Now it's slipperied up, and it can be expelled. Or sometimes we've had a time or two when it actually slid down into the stomach, but that's okay, too, because it's going down to the gastric juices that's going to continue to work on it, and it will be dissolved in about 35 minutes.
Now, that's for Yummy Combs, but what about dogs that ingest objects like, toys that they shouldn't be ingesting, or socks, or whatever it is? And that happens all the time. So the only advice that I know of that is that, you know, if your dog has done it once and survived, you're lucky. But now you know the dog may do it again. And if nothing else, you become a better housekeeper.
Yeah, you become a better housekeeper. You watch the dog when they're doing something, although they will be sneaky and try to do it when you're not paying attention for a second or two. But you know, be aware of what you have laying around the house. I have heard, I cannot confirm this, but I heard that a very well-known person who was on TV for quite a long time had a couple of dogs, and one of them, I think they were golden retrievers, one of them actually swallowed a tennis ball.
Oh, yeah, that's happened. Yep. Yeah. I don't know about who you're talking about, but I know that has happened. Dogs will actually, it's not every day, or they'll chew up part of the ball and then part of the ball goes down or doesn't go down, and that's the problem. They begin to choke on it. We have less than a minute left, and I know that you are concerned about overweight and obese dogs. We mentioned the word epidemic. Well, if half the dogs are overweight or obese, and they are, that's a problem. So in the time we have remaining, can you comment on that?
Yes. One of my points that I get excited about, I think the issue is kind of quickly, and here's how I would put it for your listening audience. I ask you this question. Do you know anyone that has ever wanted to lose a couple pounds? Every hand will go up. Now, the second question is, name the people you know that went on a high-starch diet and not a whole bunch of exercise and lost weight. I haven't had a hand go up for that yet. We need to be looking at what the protein to starch ratio in treats is, because it's not good. I can tell you that. What we've done is we have 44% protein in the Yummy Combs and less than 8% starch.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it there, Joe, just for time. The website for Yummy Combs is?
The website for Yummy Combs is petsbestlife.com.
Pets.
You can also get it at yummycombs.com.
Yeah, it sounds best. Yummycombs.com.
.com.
Joe Rately, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great day, everyone.
I've been asked to talk about this at length, so here I am about to talk about it at length. Coyotes and the bad rap that they get. You know, so here's a fact. In the Chicago metro area, compared to any other urban area in the country, there are more coyotes. There are. Does that mean you should be worried? Well, here's the thing. We are not on their menu. They do not eat people. They do not generally attack people. In fact, the only time that they might have any interest in doing that is if that individual coyote is sick, starving, something of that nature. But if that were to happen and a coyote is interested in you, and mostly it might be because you're walking your small dog, just if you know there are coyotes around, take a loud whistle with you. Take some pots and pans to bang together. The more noise you make, and this is actually true, it's called hazing. The jump up and down. The more impressive you are by making noise and looking larger, that coyote is going to lose any interest the coyote might have had in you. So if you're walking your dog, don't take one of those leashes that goes out 15 feet. Take a regular standard 6-foot leash so you have more control over your dog. And by the way, that is the right way to walk a dog anyway. But no matter, if you have a very large dog, I'm talking big, big dog, probably nothing to worry about. But if you have any dog that is like fairly large to very small and anything in between, just don't leave the dog unsupervised in your yard. It's not a good idea anyway. Dogs can sometimes escape by jumping over a fence, digging under a fence. Someone can come in and steal your dog. It does happen. So none of that to worry about. If you're out there supervising your dog, if you know there are coyotes around, just be out there with your dog or take your dog for more leash walks is all. Coyotes do us a favor, actually, because what they do is if you live in the city of Chicago, you really should appreciate how often they eat rats. That's right. But above and beyond that, other vermin like voles and gophers, sometimes they snatch squirrels or mice or rabbits, even raccoons. They'll eat fruits and berries, sometimes bird eggs if they're ground nesting birds, of course. Coyotes don't climb trees, and we give them all these superpowers that coyotes generally don't have. Also, don't feed them. There are people that do that, and by doing that, what you're doing is desensitizing the coyotes to humans, and that's not what they're afraid of us, and we want to keep it that way. Next week on the show, I am so excited to say Dr. Niels Peterson will be here, and I don't know who that is. Well, he is responsible for so much of what we know about, in cats, feline infectious peritonitis, which is now considered greatly because of Dr. Peterson, others certainly around the world, but so much because of Dr. Peterson, FIP is now considered treatable. And maybe, I'll ask him about it next week, maybe even considered curable. And the disease was once always fatal in cats, but also responsible for what we know about feline immunodeficiency virus, what we know about feline leukemia, and also brachiocephalic dogs with those pushed-in faces with limited airwaves. We'll talk about all of that next week right here on WGN, where we'll see you, talk to you bright and early.